He's on like David Cameron.
Really?
Yeah,
There
don't
must
you
be a
find that
cure for it, madam. There must be a cure for it.
odd? There probably is. I think being put in the House of Lords was his cure, wasn't
Yeah, I
it?
was attending one of the hums of poo, but it sounds like David Cameron.
Well, I think after he'd been to the palace to tell the Queen that he was resigning as the Prime Minister, somebody had a microphone as he got out of the car and went back into number 10, and he was heard humming or whistling or something.
All the way to a gypsy caravan.
I don't know what the tune. Nobody
And
really knew
now, is there
that.
not, there must be a line of consequence between that and Paddington the musical, about which I hurrah mightily.
Well, I mean,
You
there's
can't have bears cavorting around that unseemly manor.
a cure for harumphing,
Is there?
as
Could you
well.
please apply it now? Because Mrs. Trellis is at her wit's end, frankly.
I think you have to rub it on your chest.
Ah, okay. We'll
So
have
I've
to remove
heard.
the cage and the attachments first, but well, yes, okay, we'll proceed
Yeah.
with caution.
How are you?
Well, and now I hear your dulcet tones, but they're not too bad at all. And you sound, well, very chilled, given that it's a week away from, I suppose, what for some people is crunch time and D-Day,
I think Armageddon might be another word for it.
Well, you not put too fine a point on it.
Yes, a so-called friend of mine has just sent me a piece from the New Statesman talking about, there are 5,000 seats up for grabs and 2,000 Labour councillors are about to lose their seats and all this kind of stuff. So I decided that person is currently not actually a friend because that's the kind of stuff I don't need a week before polling day.
Well, isn't it? I mean, it seems to be overly blunt, shall we say. Morning, Mel.
Well,
Morning.
gleefully sending me stuff when allegedly like that when you're allegedly a friend. Go figure.
It's odd, isn't it? I think I mean I think you're the elegant breadth of your shoulders in terms of these matters, Leonie, the fact that you are able to constructively criticize the people for whom you labor, so to speak, is perhaps people feel that it can be extended just a little too far in terms of their estimation of where things are at. This tact is a somewhat archaic quality these days, particularly across the pond, is it not? Mind you, with that in mind, the King in Congress,
He was very funny.
he was extremely droll, was he not?
He's quite skilled at this. Anyone would have thought that he waited 73 years to take on this gig.
And he's not in the best of health at the moment, at least wasn't recently. I really felt he was going to be treading on eggshells. People like Ed Davies said he really shouldn't be going at all in view of the Straits of Hormuz and what have you. And
Well, I think actually perhaps it a period of silence from Ed Davey would be welcome. He can go and do a bit of paddleboarding in Lake Windermere. Alternatively, perhaps it might have been better if he'd
should I
waited.
pass him some of that embrocation, if so heartily recommended?
No, he doesn't deserve it. I think
Oh.
he might be better if he'd waited 73 years before he took on his job. I just the idea that in this anniversary year, which is actually, if everyone cares to remember, is why the king had been invited to help them celebrate. And of course, it is quite funny that the monarch of this country is going to that country to celebrate that country saying goodbye to being part of this country. So there is
You
something
cannot
quite.
but mention George the Third, yes, indeed,
I
yeah.
know. So there's something, but to accept the invitation and then not to show up would have been so rude. It's off the planet in terms of rude, and I just feel it's another one of these. Oh, the Liberal Democrats have come up with something to say because nobody was looking at them or listening to them. It's their equivalent of falling, the falling off a paddleboard. And I just was quite shocked that they
Given
would
that
make
the
that.
fact they might do relatively well, I mean, it's a Mel's sophology and yours, Leonie, very welcome here. It's probably not a good time to be saying things that are too contentious. I mean, it's one thing to disapprove of the orangery, but as you say, It's timing is everything, isn't it? Particularly on a paddle board.
I think they aren't going to do terribly well because I think they're in the middle of the road and I think they're going to get run down. That's what I reckon. I don't think they are going to. I think the main beneficiaries of next week's election are much more likely to be Reform and the Greens than the Liberal Democrats, in my opinion. But Malcolm may know more.
Well, indeed, well, both seem to have been busily shooting themselves at the foot, as is traditional, I suppose, on sort of Davian lines, I guess. Graham joining us now. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning.
Fantastic. And thank you for bringing the sunshine, all of you. It's quite extraordinary streaming through here. So, notwithstanding, I've got some rump fabrication on the go here, courtesy of Leone. Thank you very much. It's beginning to take effect, I think. Anyway, we started talking about the King's Speech. I was about to queue up Malcolm in terms of his estimation of the Lib Dems' chances. We got on to Ed Davey's cancellation of would-be cancellation of the King's trip. Can I come to you in a second, Graham? Mal, did the boy do well, first of all? And
Yeah, but I mean,
what about the
I
Lib
think
Dems?
this is precisely why it was a good idea for Charles to go to the US at this time, is that he's in a position where he can very, very clearly not say things that nobody else could have said.
That's exactly it, isn't it?
Yeah, and Trump is not in a position to. I don't know if Trump's bright enough to recognize what the king was saying. But I thought it was quite a tour de force from the king and whoever his advisors
Absolutely.
were, that they got the tone absolutely right. And it was, as Leonie said, it was very funny, which is always a very good way to if you can use humor in bringing someone down, it's often so much more effective than just a head-on rant or diatribe.
Was so
And
gentle, wasn't it? I mean, this team of writers involved in this, I'd rather like one of these American late shows that Trump so derides.
it's the delivery, though, Andy, as well. He was
Yeah, indeed.
very good at doing it. He really delivers it. But, as I said, he waited 73 years for this gig. So he bloody ought to be, because he's had a bit of practice, kind of not completely in the public eye. Very, very good. But I expected him to be good. I don't know, I mean, what Malcolm or Graham think, because after Trump did all that, I'm going to annex Canada. And then Mark Carney won the election, and they were having their state opening of the Canadian Parliament after the election. And barely ever does the British monarch go to open it. And the King turned up and opened it without much fanfare. But if that isn't a big signal to certain people to say, hands off Canada, I don't know what is. But without saying a single word.
As you say, showing up is half the battle, isn't it?
He's very good. He's very, very good.
In terms of the polls do suggest the Lib Dems will make some gains on Thursday, but as Leonie says, they're struggling at the moment. So it's become a more and more crowded realm politics. I just looking at 15 candidates in West Hill Ward, with the Greens putting up two and everybody else putting up a whole slate. I think the most we've had before, we might have got up to 11 once. But in that crowd, the Lib Dems' unique selling point of not being Labour or Tory, most of the candidates now, I think probably, maybe not for the first time, but it may be for the first time that the majority of candidates across Wandsworth are not Labour or Tory. And so the Lib Dems' selling point is saying, well, neither of those two. Is now actually saying, well, actually, we're none of those four alternatives. It's a much weaker stance, unless you've got a really clear vision of what you want to do with it. And, like
And
all
you've reasonable
Labour,
chances of winning,
the Greens
you
and
think.
Reform have pretty, it's pretty clear where the Greens and the Reforms are coming from. I find both of their philosophies pretty unpleasant, I have to say, but I know what they are. I don't really quite know what the Lib Dems stand for, what gets them up in the morning, which of course is something I've said before about the Prime Minister as well. And competence and common sense is extremely important in politics, but so is a sense of direction and vision. The most successful national governments have been those which knew where they wanted to go and were pretty competent in getting there. And I guess Blair and Thatcher are the two names that may come to mind most readily. And of course, post-war Attlee are the ones that might most readily come to mind about that. And if you haven't got, I mean, if you're blatantly incompetent, as we saw from some of the conservative string of conservative prime ministers we recently had, you don't get very far. But just competence on its own doesn't do it either. And I'm not sure I could put on a sort of side of paper what the Lib Dems stand for in these elections.
Well, I suppose the blatant incompetence is, in a way, a sort of a roundabout argument for small government, isn't it? But it got, in a sense, one wheel on its wagon. So, Graham, would you like to give us your view of the King's performance and the effect it may have in terms of the warm reception it received in Congress? And I'm not quite sure why we're yoking the two, but it's again, perhaps it's this angling through of a fresh approach, if it thus it be, in what Mal points out is now crowded field, in sort of in the middle of things.
Well, I thought it was superbly delivered. And it reminded me of Biden's address to the Knesset, and that
Interesting parallel.
gets on the side of the audience, and then he just lays down the law. It wasn't followed, of course, but the point is that it said it, but I think King Charles went further, that people actually understood what he was saying.
Which is quite some feat, isn't it? Looking at some of the faces of the chamber there.
Well, that's the subtlety of the delivery,
It seems
is the way
stunned.
it did communicate to both sides. Both sides were applauding, standing ovation from both sides. And apart from Vance, who refused to accept it, they all stood up and clapped. So I think it's a great example of, I think it should be repeated often as to how you communicate without offending people. And Trump, not to be offended, shows exactly how much it communicated, because he didn't understand what he was talking about, probably. So I think it was just
Unkind,
superb.
unkind, unkind. I think it's, I may have understood some, but it's that and I think it, it's that self-deprecating humor, that's ability to say one thing and mean something slightly different, the reading between the lines elements, it's all of that sort of subtlety. And I do feel the king has slightly mastered all of those things. He's very, very good. And has Trump not announced already that he's going to take tariffs off Scotch whiskey or something to say thank you to the king? Or have I completely invented that? I thought that's what's being said.
Well, he made the comment that the king would have supported the war in Iran.
I know he said some odd things, Trump, but leaving those
That
to one
indicates he
side.
doesn't understand. That indicates exactly he didn't understand what he was saying.
Or didn't understand all of it necessarily.
It's
No,
a slightly. Trump is impossible not to take his interpretation over everyone else's and assume it's the only one. That's his
I
narcissism.
know. I
And
know.
so he can't understand, because he can only see things in one way. So he can't
I
see the other person's side.
I know. It's sort of heartening in a way, isn't it?
Well,
That the
presumably, I mean, the nature of being in distillery means that you wait an awful long time, and you're doing a niche product, and you are therefore on fairly tight margins. Also, there's the impending danger of your distillery becoming a golf course overnight by declaration of EDI.
Now, I've just looked it up, and it does say on my search engine that the tariffs on Scotch whiskey were removed by President Trump following a visit from the King and Queen of the United Kingdom. The decision was made to strengthen the relationship between the Scotch industry and the American bourbon industry, because one of the problems that's a side effect of the tariffs is a lot of Scotch whiskey is aged in the barrels that are previously used for bourbon.
Of course.
And so the bourbon makers in Middle America and Kentucky and such like have been struggling to find anything to do with their barrels, which apparently I presume they would
presumably
have
to use them to sail across to lobby Congress, wouldn't they, had the king not done this?
Anyway, so it's all been costing everybody lots of money, lost exports, and also it's going to boost the distillers in America as well as ones in Scotland. So that's a great outcome, even if nothing else is an outcome from this visit.
Well, wherever you stand on alcohol, always drink responsibly at Al. I mean, it's in itself justifies the price of admission, does it? Odd.
I think so.
In the context of what happened with the previous trade envoy.
Well, I think it's
so
just
to speak.
I think it's just as well that that bloke, I can't remember his name, he's not really
no,
been in
it's
the
just
news.
Lost in the midst
hardly,
of time now, isn't it?
Hardly in the news much this week. But is it a jolly good thing that he wasn't the US ambassador at the moment? Otherwise, he would have been hosting the King and Queen at the reception that they went to on Monday night. Can you imagine what that would have looked like?
Well, you wonder if he does at some level still have some levers of power so that some people could mysteriously disappear from the table and then reappear at different places and so forth.
I think that chapter is closed. That is now closed.
So many will breathe a sigh of relief. But
there will not now be another comeback.
They said, didn't they, of Johnson, that the reason he survived so long was that he knew where the bodies were buried.
Mm.
We now discover that some...
They're all in his backyard, I think.
Well, yeah, most probably. There's a lot of it about, as Barry Cryer would say. But then thank God for the ostriches in safari parks that deliver poetic justice occasionally. We now know that somewhere between 7 and 20 civil servants knew a little bit of some of the increments that Graham and I were musing on last time. That and the local elections are a bit of a smoking gun for Starmer, aren't they? And, people have been saying all week, will he stay or will he go?
I think it's not just the locals. It's also the Senedd in Wales and the Scottish Parliament in Scotland. So that, and those are at a different level than just the local government elections. I think it's very fair to point that out.
It is, isn't it? I mean, on the face of it, a richer picture in terms of democracy. But some have predicted recently, as you say, more or less the perhaps temporary demise of Labour in Wales. The picture was pretty dire in Scotland until recently. There seems to be something of resurgence there. And a little bit of local intelligence being brought to bear, as it is in our corner of the world.
Well, in our corner of the world, specifically in Wandsworth, it could be Malcolm, who is the deciding factor in Wandsworth Council after next Thursday.
It often is, isn't
and,
it?
And Malcolm could hold the balance of power, so he may not be able to come on this podcast because he'll be so busy deciding on absolutely everything.
It's a strange... It's actually going to be quite an interesting post-election period for me because I'm now a lead regional peer with the Local Government Association. And change of control stuff is one of the main things that the...
Sorry, could you just explain that role a little bit now?
Yeah, so the Local Government Association, which is what it says on the tin, it's the association that I think pretty much every principal council in the country is a member of it. Wandsworth left it for a while, but it's rejoined.
Let's be frank. Wandsworth left it under the Conservatives because they didn't want to pay to be a member, and it was
of the embrocation of Rumpf, didn't they?
And it was rejoined under the current Labour administration because they felt it was important to be part of it.
Yes, that's entirely accurate.
thank you.
I don't think I implied differently. That's certainly the case. It lobbies on behalf of local government with central government and other bodies. It offers some really very good training courses, collection of things. There's a thing called the
You run
Leadership
some of them,
Academy.
don't you? Yep,
That's
yep.
why I used to teach on the Leadership Academy, which was a fascinating, yeah, from my point of view, as a one of the trainers, I always learned a vast amount from meeting colleagues from across the council. And of course, it works very well cross-party because in politics, they often say that the opposition of the people on the other side of the chamber and the enemy of the people on the same side, that you are inevitably your direct competitors, the people in your own party who are vying for the positions of leadership within that group. There's no reason why a Conservative from Herefordshire and a Labour politician from, I don't know, Gateshead and a Lib Dem from Portsmouth and so on. They're not really rivals in any very
Like
direct
pairing of the
sense.
commons, I guess, isn't it? Yeah.
And so actually people work extremely well cross-party in both the LGA and its training courses. But one of the things it has is a set of lead peers, and these are councillors with a bit of experience behind them, and they're elected on a party basis. So I'm with the independent group at the LGA, and they have a job. So the sort of things I've been doing as a lead peer, I've had a couple of quite long discussions with people, independent councillors, who are having trouble with a particular element of what's going on in their lives, and I just have a chat through with them of what the options might be, and really give them a chance to express what's going on and find their own solutions.
Mentorship, yeah.
And one of the things that happens after each election is all the political groups are geared up for change of control work. So if a
Are you
party
having a
is.
chat with you must be having a chat with yourself at the moment then, Malcolm.
Well, I don't know. It's going to be interesting because I can't really, as the lead peer for London and the South East, come to myself and ask myself for help in dealing with the situation. But I have, for example, I've
It's
been
not a
working.
case of free collective bargaining, is it?
I've been working in the Isle of Wight, which is a very interesting politics, always has been, because of, by definition it's quite insular, and it's and quite possibility there. It's at the moment run by a coalition of various independent groups, and I've done a couple of sessions on member officer relationships and things with them. But post-election, I'm going down there for a session with their new councillors and another session with existing councillors and officers, depending on, just giving a few thoughts about how they can make the whatever the new council is work. And it's a really fascinating role, and so quite independent of what's going on with Wandsworth, it's going to be a period. And even if I lose my seat, I've still got a year as lead peer before I have to give it up, so I can still do this work even if the good folk of West Hill take against me, which I have to say
I think
they don't seem to be.
I was going to say, I think the chances of that happening, Malcolm, is about as much as Donald Trump deciding that he wants to be a really nice man and he's just going to let Iran do whatever they like in the Straits of Hormuz. Neither of those things are likely to happen. The chances of you losing your seat, I would say, are about minus 10 million. The only thing that I'm really interested in is will you or will I get the highest number of votes? Do you remember last time? You beat me. I was very upset. And your
I think
majority
most
was.
places we've been close, haven't we? Yeah.
So, Andy, sorry, this is a private Wandsworth joke, but after Malcolm, who's got the largest vote in numbers and then the largest majority, I've then got the largest vote and the largest majority out of all the other councillors on Wandsworth Council. These things are completely meaningless because Malcolm and I are not standing against each other. So apropos of what he was just saying about people to and actually having the largest vote and the largest majority are completely irrelevant. If you win by one vote, you become a councillor. So it
Just the
makes
stuff of
literally.
legend, though.
It makes no difference whether your majority is one or 3,000, actually,
Well, I
in
suppose
practice, does it?
I'm
But
pretty certain.
just to sort of put a gloss on what Malcolm is saying, because he's giving us the how it might work out in other councils, and they're talking a lot about councils, for example, let's say Lambeth, which is currently run by
That's where I
Labour,
was when the ripple went through and you guys had your results announced.
I think Lambeth. I don't know the precise figures, so these are. I'm just going to do this as round numbers. But let's say there's 58 councillors in Lambeth, and it might be 55 and it might be 60. About 50 of the councillors in Lambeth at the moment are Labour out of 58. And so lots of people say, oh, the Greens are going to win. But of course, there are actually already Liberal Democrat councillors in Lambeth, and some of them
the big two arrests, haven't they? The Twin councillors this week.
We can come on to that in a minute, if you like. There's just been a Conservative candidate in Wandsworth who has just been completely repudiated by the Wandsworth Conservatives because she said similar sort of. Well, she said Hitler was right about Jews, so I can't think why they suspended her. I mean, what's
very odd. It's clearly it's not Badenoch led. I mean, you know, this foot and mouth stuff. Anyway,
No, I think I think it was insanity led in this case. I mean, just being charitable there. But so if the Greens may gain lots of seats in one part of Lambeth. But I don't know all the ins and outs of Lambeth, but given that there are already Liberal Democrats in split wards elsewhere in Lambeth, it seems likely that the Liberal Democrats will probably make some gains as well. So you may end up with a situation where there's a sort of group of Greens and a group of Liberal Democrats and then a group of Labour. And the question will be, can anyone get to, I don't know, let's say, 32 seats or something so that they can run the council with a bit of a majority, or will the council be sort of split in three directions? And then how do you do the transfer from the current situation, which is that it's everything's all run by Labour, to a situation where you do two parties get together and work together? In Wandsworth, it's obviously it's much more Labour and Conservative, and then there's Malcolm. He is just the one lone individual who's survived through elections and actually re-won his seat. We do currently have a reform councillor who was elected as a Tory. I suspect that that seat will return to the Conservatives. So Wandsworth could be 29 Conservative, 28 Labour and Malcolm, or it could be 29 Labour, 28 Conservative and Malcolm. Malcolm's in the middle.
Extraordinary.
Malcolm is the decide. Well, a lot of the pundits are saying Wandsworth is too close to call. So the figures I've just given you would be the outcome of an entirely too close to call. I mean, I don't know what the result is going to be, obviously. So I'm just
a little interesting fact.
So Malcolm's running. Malcolm for leader. Malcolm for leader.
Gosh, that would be some negotiation. That would be some negotiation, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be an interesting negotiation. I mean, I think you should start your negotiation there, Malcolm. What do you reckon? You just say you can have my vote, and I'll vote with you so long as I'm the leader. What do you reckon?
Well, there is a precedent in Mole Valley.
The dizzy corridors of power.
I knew you'd know that there was a precedent.
in Mole Valley District Council, where the Ashford Independents. were a small political party and when the Lib Dems and the Tories were tied, the leadership of the council ended up going to the leader of the Ashford Independents. I think there's only three of them. He was a great, widely respected on all sides, a really great guy, and I think it was a unique set of circumstances there. But there is a little precedent out there. I'm going to give an interesting fact that Mark Justin, the reform candidate,
the defector,
he was elected with 328 votes because
I know
Nine Elms ward is one of these wards. Yeah, we had the boundary changes in the year 2000 for the 2002 election. And these boundary changes are supposed to happen roughly every 20 years, which has been the pattern in Wandsworth. Now, Nine Elms is developing at a huge rate, but haven't yet developed. So all of these high-rise flats were going up at that point. And they had to come to a guess as to how many people would actually be living there on the electoral register in 10 years' time. Hence, you ended up with a ward that had very, very few voters at the time of the 2002 election. And I'm pretty certain this is the case, but the gap between the number of votes won by the candidate who got most votes and the number of votes won by the candidate who got the least votes who were elected it's very difficult to imagine anywhere else there's been a spread between someone elected on, Leonie and I, sort of around 3,300, 3,700, that sort of range, and someone elected with 328 votes. It's just quite extraordinary.
It is odd, isn't it? Of course, so many people have bought these properties at Nine Elms as investments, and they're not necessarily going to be there on election day because they're shitting around the world.
It's quite possible in 10 years there might have to be an emergency rewarding set up, an emergency boundary change, because the electorate, I understand, in Nine Elms has not been growing at the projected rate when it was put together. And ultimately, by law, the number of voters per elector can't vary by more than 10% unless there's a very good reason. So the last rewarding, West Hill kept its boundaries pretty much identically. The only change was that the western platform of the district line, which was in West Hill, is now in Southfield's ward. But the number of people who actually live on the western platform of Southfield station is relatively few.
I think it's just mice, actually, Malcolm, at the moment. I don't think there's I don't think there are any humans living there. There's just mice.
And even the Greens aren't suggesting that mice should get the vote. So
well, if it gets that close, I mean,
Well, yeah, indeed. So now West Hill is actually about 5% below.
You'd have to get as well, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Per average. But Nine Elms, obviously, is completely skewed, miles and miles away from the average number of voters per councillor across the borough. And if that doesn't improve when people actually start moving into these rather than them being used as investments, then they may have to look again at the boundaries in that part of Battersea and sort them out again.
I cut past all the way to the city over weekend, and I have to say, so many people seem to spend their lives in their shopping. And if you could extend the principle of voting there, they sort of live there a little bit. Couldn't this not? Anyway, just a passing thought. Graham has been patiently observing what we've been saying here. I wonder if I could ask you about something that I would suggest might be related. Andy Burnham, of course, seeking to inveigle his way back into mainstream politics.
He's saying, a man with lovely, lovely eyelashes. He's got lovely.
Well, and this will vindicate presumably any suggestion that he's an art strategist of different kith and kilter to those abroad at the moment, perhaps. But he's saying that the mayoral agenda needs to be replicated across the country for Labour to renew its appeal. Would you agree with that?
Are you talking to Graham this time?
I am, initially, yes. Please come back, guys.
Well, I think it comes back to the language being used. I mean, if they're trying to replace Starmer with him, they're obviously using a different language than they're using that Kemi Badenoch is using against him in the House of Commons, which shows exactly a different level of misunderstanding. It shows that she doesn't understand.
So that's a major breakthrough. It's a different level of misunderstanding. Yes.
Yeah, well, she doesn't understand the Constitution, or Starmer doesn't understand it either, apparently, because neither of them can understand why he wasn't informed.
Yeah.
Under the Constitution. And this is why I said he'll only remain if he reappoints
Robbins.
Ollie Robbins. It's amazing what Robbins. We can do, isn't it, to name recognition. I had that too for a moment.
A week later and he's vanished from everybody's memories.
Yeah.
And Morgan McSweeney back to an encore, though. But anyway, it's after an answer time. Yeah.
The
yeah.
injustice of his sacking hasn't been erased, I don't think. And it's still being held against Starmer. So I think that's the... It does all come down to the language, because not understanding, of course, leads to aggression and opposition.
It seems to be a variation of the set. Sorry. Yeah.
The interest, that's the contrast with the king, the way he says it. He says exactly the same thing, but he says it so no one disagrees with him.
The points that are being made stick.
Yeah, he's using the right language that both people understand but not offended by. But Kemi Badenoch sets out to offend.
She does. She does. She really does. I told you about my experience of her deliberately setting out to offend, to the extent that if I was in the old building, because we were assembly members together between 2016 when I was elected and 2017 when she left and went off to become the MP for Saffron Walden, I actually stopped getting into the lift with her if we'd ever been in a meeting together, because the travel from, you know, the lower ground floor up to the sixth floor, and my office was on the seventh, hers was on the sixth, was extremely unpleasant, because she literally does go out of her way to be offensive and unpleasant. She particularly, I think, reserves some unpleasantness for people from different tribes. She's a very tribal Tory, and absolutely will not, you know, she can barely speak to you if you're Labour, which I find so offensive. I mean, and what Malcolm was just saying about people able to work cross-party, obviously really important if there is no overall control. She's, as far as I understand it, also from talking to people who work in Parliament and such like, that she's not even very good at working with people in the Tory party who don't share her particular brand of Tory politics any more than she can bear to speak to people. She's very rude.
She seems to have done quite well at PMQs, but are you saying, in effect, sort of interrupt you, that it's that sense of belligerence which a lot of people take for, well, almost affectionate jousting in a sense? It's the old routine, isn't it, as per Comedy Central in the States. It is actually natural territory that she takes her belligerence seriously and believes it's going to achieve something. Perhaps a little bit in extremis, like that Wandsworth candidate who was sent the other day of youth congruence of temporary insanity.
Yeah, but she did reveal herself, of course, and she reveals that she's not interested in the interest of the country. She would have gone to war in Iran. She's only interested in getting rid of her opposition. I don't think she'll get anywhere, because people can pick that up very well.
Yeah, she does expose herself. I think you're absolutely right, Graham. She's, she does expose what she's
That's
all about.
That's a rather alarming thought for this time of day. Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why people don't like Trump, because he does the same thing.
But it's a sort of populism, isn't it? And if Reform are going to do relatively well, it's the sort of thing that they typically get up to, isn't it, in order to achieve that notoriety.
I think the Reform are going
The danger of Farage, of course, is that he can do it without offending people, like Trump. Who often
Farage
says
uses humour like the king as well. Farage is very funny. And, you know, nobody, you can't, you know, he's like Boris Johnson. They're both very skillful politicians. You know, I'm not saying I agree with anything that they have to say on any topic, but and Boris Johnson is very charming if you meet him in person, and is always very friendly. Which, you know, I've just said exactly the opposite about Kemi Badenoch. It's really interesting the bits of people's personalities that they bring into politics, and the bits that the sort of politics, and when they're doing politics, that's exaggerated. I mean, you must have noticed this, Malcolm, that, you know, people who are one way when you talk to them outside the chamber are very different when they are performing within the chamber. I mean, my main role at the moment now is just to sit in the back row and make occasional jokes, usually at the expense of Peter Graham, who then comes to talk to me afterwards and he finds them funny. So long as Peter Graham is still finding them funny, I think everyone else is entitled to laugh.
Well, I think it's one of the things that increasingly attracted me to the idea of being independent, is that I don't have to get involved in this tribalism. The fact of the matter is
that
with maybe two or three exceptions, I think everybody in the council chamber in Wandsworth is a bright, committed individual whose main job in life is to try and make life better for the people that they represent. And of course, you know, rightly, one of the wonderful things of a democracy is that we can disagree both on what it means for life, for things to be better, which is this business about political direction, and how to get there, which is political competence. So, quite rightly, we have, there are debates on policy, which is what politics should be about. But it can be done without the level of just unpleasantness between the two political groups on the council at the moment, the outgoing council, clearly. It's on the sort of bad end of where it has been at various times in my sort of 32 years in the chamber. And
well,
I think
between the leadership, leadership of the groups, I think you should say, I don't think, as I just said, I get on very well with lots of people across the chamber. And there are those of us who still do that. I too deprecate the fact that there has been a lot of bad behaviour in the chamber from the Labour side as well as the Tory side, I have to say. And I don't think it's helpful. And I completely agree with you, Malcolm, that it's an absolute shame that there has been quite a lot of that going on. Maybe after next Thursday, there might be a bit less. That would be nice to see, I think. That would be a good change.
I hope so, but the problem, people don't get elected for the first time like that. It gets pretty much everybody. Very few people go in as a candidate saying I'm going to be really nasty to the other side in the chamber. People often say I'm going to go in and work with anybody, work cross party and be sensible with it. And it's the political culture then that it's almost institutional that anybody who goes into it would inevitably end up being dragged in that direction, however valiantly they might resist that. Mm. And of course, I was talking earlier about change of control. The churn in terms of people who will be in the council chamber for the first time across the country for this next election, I suspect is going to be its highest ever. I suspect we're going to see the highest number of those councils that are all out. There may be some of those which are, pretty much, 60, 70, 80% new councillors. We saw that with Kent County Council and others last year.
It's going to be a very busy man.
So you don't get, would you guess, Leanne, we're somewhere between a third and a half of councillors turnover in a typical Wandsworth election, somewhere of that sort of region, probably closer to a third than a half. So you've got both new people coming in who haven't been, become institutional politicians yet and who still see the world like normal people see it. But also you've got a political culture that they can grow into, that at least the basics about working constructively with officers, but holding them to account, and how you get casework done and what works and what doesn't work in the chamber. There's that basic, enough people to learn from. If you've got a council where almost everybody is new, then it's a real danger that the thing, as we've seen in some of the, it happens to be reform. I'm not actually making an anti-reform point. I think any party which suddenly
has itself
in power would find the same kind of problem. Because as Leonie knows, it's a funny job. We're responsible to the people who directly elect us, so the people who first down or West Hill or wherever it happens to be. But we're also non-executive directors of a pretty large corporation. Wandsworth Council's total budget is well over £2 billion a year. And we are the non-exec directors of that. Now, that's an immediate tension, because if something is good for the borough but not good for your ward, you've got an immediate tension. And then on top of that, of course, for almost everybody in the chamber, they're also responsible to their party and they have to square things with their party as well. So working to those sort of three different bosses, it's not, there are very few jobs out there, I think, which are like that. And people coming in need to be guided as to how to manage those tensions. And that requires a base of experienced councillors there. And we may well see a lot of councils in difficulty with culture if they've got vast numbers of new members who don't really quite know what to do. I always refer to the Boston Bypass Party at this point.
Indeed, and now, there's still full money in some distant shire, are they not?
They had a single policy, which was a bypass for Boston, and they also had for Boston Borough Council, which doesn't have that responsibility because Lincolnshire County Council is responsible for roads. So the only thing that held them together was a policy they couldn't deliver, and something like 32 of them out of 36 got elected. And have not the slightest idea of what they wanted to do. And even if they did know, haven't know what they wanted to do, which they didn't, they wouldn't have known how to do it.
Well, they've had their day with HS2, haven't they? Which is now going to be shorter and slower than the one we've already got.
I don't think there was an HS2 party in
Boston. Oh, okay. Well,
but and the whole thing fell apart.
Malcolm, let's start one immediately.
Yes. Well, someone's got to do it.
Well, we would have as much chance as Wandsworth Council of successfully getting a bypass for Boston.
Diversion.
No, no, I meant the HS2 party. Let's start.
We're going to order the cones now.
Well, I think the same applies, actually.
So, Andy, you need to give me one further chance to find out if Malcolm, if he was the leader of Wandsworth, would he put me in his cabinet?
I'll swap it for a jar of your most excellent embrocation.
I think I should be told by Malcolm now, a week in advance of polling day, whether he would select me to be one of his cabinet members. In the imaginary situation that he holds the balance of power and both of the other parties have said, oh, all right, you can be the leader.
We could ask a prediction from the great and esteemed Mr. Graham here, but let's see what the let's hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Look, I know my place in all this. It's all fun, but
oh, Malcolm, I'm very you're dodging the question. I feel Prime
well,
Minister.
Well, to continue the dodge a little bit, I wonder if we could peer back into the mists of time. It's been roughly 50 years, would you believe, since Jim Callaghan exited Number 10 Downing Street. There was a little presentation and disquisition by his daughter, one of the Jay Dynasty and various other luminaries. Peter Kellner was there. I'm wondering whether his, in the current climes in which Labour finds itself, the Callaghan legacy looms a little bit.
Well, Callaghan was one of the prime ministers that I actually met. He said exactly... what I've been saying.
In what context, Grant? Do you remember?
He said lies get around halfway around the world before you got your boots on. The truth gets its boots on.
Well, you were speaking truth to power, no doubt, graciously received. I'm just wondering on what occasion you met him.
I think it was after the winter of discontent.
Just as well.
The occasion was just a social party, you know. I mean, was given by someone who always mixed everyone. I met all sorts of people there, from famous actors to disreputable politicians.
Something that Callaghan, he'd had such a ropey old time, was
you mean like
prepared
me and Malcolm
to do
there?
That, to be there.
I want to meet some disreputable
chambers.
I'm trying to build a new reputation for us, Malcolm. You don't think being disreputable is where I should start?
Oh, well, I thought you meant that referring to us as famous actors. That's right.
Well, I thought he said disreputable. Disreputable politicians, I thought he said.
He did, yeah, but I thought he was referring to us. He was talking about the famous actors.
Orators.
Disreputable, I was talking about Enoch Powell.
Somebody said this week was in, actually wasn't this week, it was the late, great David Jacobs talking about his time in Streatham, which I found quite illuminating. Is this also the fact that, you know, his besties on any questions back in the day were Hugh Scammon and Enoch Powell, two of the most contentious figures who, on the long lines of what Mal was alluding to earlier on, had this sort of hidden cross-party aspect to them, as it were.
Well, Enoch Powell is extremely mild in comparison to the current racists.
I suppose some would say he laid the groundwork for what they're now able to do.
Yeah,
they think
it's been escalated ever since by social media, and that's the way the language works. People compete with each other to be rude to each other, and it shows in the anti-Semitism arguments. You know, it's simply not working.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I mean, there was more to the man, and there was more to Jim Callaghan than what they initially remember for, one suspects. I mean, but it's hard to find nuance in the face of, well, first of all, the recessionary climate Callaghan was dealing with, and imminent rise of Margaret Thatcher, that kind of seismic change, and in a very different part of the forest, what's been going on with the gradual surging of racism.
Yeah. And if you, the Malcolm's point about, you know, you get new people coming in, and they simply don't have the skill to communicate what they're trying to do.
Yeah. See, I can't see Starr at one of these pleasant social gatherings without a script these days, anyway. It just, you know, it's always looking over his shoulder.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think Mark Carney's speech and the King's speech will hopefully lead the way out, you know, which it seems to be by Orban being got rid of and Moldova not being affected by billions put in by Russia for the party against.
Yes, and they've been dirt poor for the longest time, haven't they? But they're not they're not blinking.
Yeah, and so I think this is the beginning of the movement against the extreme wealth. And people are finding out how to bring equality back in terms of wealth. But it's only at the very beginning, of course, and Trump isn't doing much to help.
but no, just helping himself, around. Helping himself, I think. There's been some interesting points made about lots of stocks and shares being bought in the 2 or 3 minutes just before an announcement is made by the White House. And I think...
Indeed, by one Hexeth the Evangelist.
Somebody's helping themselves.
It's almost a policy he's got, you know, to give his mates a sure bet.
The excellent Robert Reich was saying that we're back to greed is good in terms of, you know, the riding high of that in the 80s, again, post-Callaghan over here.
No, it there's also quite a lot of evidence of Trump and his friends buying up very cheaply tech companies, then giving them huge government contracts and cashing in on their share price going through the roof. I mean, greed is good. At the heart of greed is good was a kind of sense that the people who are motivated to make money are the ones who end up paying the taxes that keep the rest of us going.
Yeah, decoded a bit. It's not all bad.
And so greed is good was absolutely not an argument in favour of dishonesty and hiding things. It was a position which is quite widespread. It was always noticeable to the Social Democrats in Germany. When they were sort of skirting around power, it was always very clear that they were in favour of big business in Germany being successful, because they could then tax them. And it's how all societies work ultimately.
German prosperity was during the 80s. I remember was I thought rather a pleasant place to be.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Well, after the unification, the speed with which they rehabilitated East Germany, if I can put it that way, and started to bring it back into the industrial mainstream in Germany, was very impressive indeed. And it was based upon an idea that the left in Germany was not in a position of criticising big business all the time. It was a matter of saying, do what you... someone far less reputable than the Germans once said that he was extremely relaxed about people making large amounts of money, as long as they paid their taxes. And I think that's the point that... greed, whether it's a greed for money or greed for publicity or greed for progress or whatever it is, has actually been the driving force for an awful lot of good that's gone on in the world, because ultimately it ends up with most people benefiting, not everybody, but most people benefiting. Greed is good. It sounds like a rather nasty thing, but actually I think it was the Rockefeller used to say there were two moral imperatives in life. The first was to make as much money as you possibly could, and the other was to give away as much money as you possibly could. And I think it's an interesting take that I think has quite a lot of merit to it.
Yeah, it's not quite the same thing, but in the wake of Terry Jones's sculpture going up in Colwyn Bay, at the time, Eric Idle thinking of the life of Brian as Jesus Christ's lust for glory.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, sidebar.
The only problem with Malcolm's argument is if you get corruption driving growth of companies and growth of wealth is that they're all making money out of the wrong thing.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Extreme damage to
the karma hits, doesn't it? You think of the Volkswagen scandal, which I agree is not an entire nation, but at the same time, it seemed to symbolise a creeping cynicism. And now we find Olaf Scholz parting company with Trump. I mean, obviously, it's not difficult to do that because everything it turns on a sixpence over there at the moment. But he's needing to assert himself, isn't he? And perhaps the vestiges of what Germany was, you know, intellectually, in that consensus you've just so eloquently described, Al, besurging a little bit.
Well, that's the end result is that they begin to fall out. And now you're getting the fossil industry falling out with each other. And they've got a stalemate in a global war. Where it's Iran versus the rest, and including Russia.
Indeed. You're thinking perhaps of the UAE exiting OPEC this week, which we should have gone on to. I mean, is that going to make a huge dent in matters, Mal? And how will they go it alone? What will it affect the recovery process, if it's such a be, economically?
Sorry, say that again.
I was thinking about the UAE's departure from OPEC this week. Sorry, it's a bit of a googly.
Yes, it's an interesting point. I mean, OPEC's great days, obviously, were in the 70s when they held the whole world to a stranglehold after 1973, when they really got their act together. From the mid-80s onwards, it's been a much less powerful body. In part, of course, because the world responded to the oil shock of the 70s. So you started getting alternative sources.
There's a bit of zeitgeist,
And that led to the fracking revolution, but also to a lot of the exploitation of conventional oil fields, which would have been too expensive to develop pre-1973. But when the oil price quadrupled in 1973, they became economically viable. And, of course, development of alternative sources of energy. So the coal industry globally had a big boost in the early 80s. Nuclear was expanding quite strongly at that point. You hadn't really got to the beginning of the renewable revolution where we are now at that stage. But so as a result, you know, we get oil from a lot more places. In effect, it was that sort of elliptical area that included the Middle East and Russia was responsible for something of the order of three quarters of the world's oil, if not production and reserves, if not more. Now, of course, you've got the Venezuelas, you've got the African countries beginning to develop oil exploration. The North Sea has been an important place for fossil extraction, oil and gas. So OPEC was always, it was never, you know, as powerful as it was. If you look at it, the reason why oil prices have gone up recently has not been because of OPEC policy in the way that it was in the 70s. It's been because of things like the invasion of Ukraine and the what's going on at the moment in the Straits of Hormuz. So I think it's become far more of a political statement as to whether you're allied with OPEC than it has been an actual very, very powerful industrial tool as it was 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, people think of the geography of where the stuff is produced and the cost of carting it around the globe, which I suppose if you're a Putin is not too much of a worry, at least hasn't been. But without a place on the international economic stage for his oil, he'd be up a gum tree, really, wouldn't he? So how just fancy that when the embargo is removed by one Trump the other day. Leonie, would you concur with that analysis? I mean, in terms of the backdrop of the cost of living and the dire presentiments a few weeks ago that we were going to face major food shortages and might yet.
Yeah, I still don't think we know what the full impact is going to be of this completely mad adventure that Donald Trump has taken on. I mean, one thing that it could do is lead to huge problems.
He's no Biggles, is he?
For him in the midterm elections, which are coming up in the States in November, because two of the things that helped him win before he took office, you know, January 25, when he won in November 24, were that he said he was going to, I mean, I heard lots of vox pops with Americans saying, you know, the cost of the grocery bill has gone through the roof. And Trump says he's going to tackle that. Well, I don't think this activity, all the tariffs or any of the things that he's been doing economically are helping any. And now gas prices as well as grocery shopping costs have gone through the roof in the States. So, and also he said no more forever wars. And for about a year, until the end of February of this year, he was endlessly saying that he deserved the Nobel Peace Prize for all the wars he'd ended. And then suddenly he went and abducted Maduro. Well, it didn't actually start a war. And then he went into Iran and now appears to be sort of stuck. And, you know, having this sort of Mexican standoff in the Straits of Hormuz with Iran. And I don't think they've got the faintest idea, the Americans, how to get themselves back out of this, because they can't just back down and say, hey, it's all right, the Straits of Hormuz can be run by Iran. I mean, I think they've got themselves and the rest of the world into a really crazy position now. But it could have big impacts for him in the States if the Democrats can get their act together. And in terms of, I mean, ever since Trump came in, I know that obviously the conservative opposition, the shadow chancellor and the Badenoch team want to throw rocks at the government for everything they've done wrong. But on the economic front, it's hard to imagine that any government of whatever stripe running the country would have not faced enormous difficulties from the implementation of the tariffs, which, you know, removing them from Scotch whiskey, and they're talking about all the benefit of that. So, you know, the disbenefit of tariffs over the last year on on all kinds of products has been huge. But then this war has now taken the impact of the Trump regime, tariffs all last year, you know, and now we've got this. And there are so many things that are being impacted, you know, fertilizer, helium, obviously the issue about oil and gas that's, you know, 20% coming through. And it could have a huge impact, of course, on the war on the eastern end of Europe, because the Americans have, you know, taken sanctions off Russian oil that's in transit. But if this goes on for months, you know, I can see them taking, you know, sanctions off Russian oil altogether. So, you know, disbenefits for Trump potentially at the polls, huge benefits potentially for Putin on the battlefield, certainly in terms of money for him.
Presumably will take care of his old buddy.
And it, you know, we know that a lot of the weapons that Putin has been using have been Iranian drones. So I think this closeness between Russia and Iran is going to potentially deepen. So I can't see any benefits to what Trump did at the end of February at all for anybody, including for him. So it is the most peculiar war for him to have got himself involved in, and it completely contradicts everything he stood for in terms of no more forever wars, and I'm going to tackle the cost of living in the States. But yeah, the impact on us is not going to be good either.
Yeah, as of today, I think under the American Constitution, this war has to be approved by Congress. And certainly in terms of the cross-examination Hegseth et al. Were getting the other day, it rather seemed as if some of the Republicans have woken up. Those who were bold enough to say, look, you know, this is my livelihood, Gov, or this is the, you know, this is going to cost us at the midterms, as you say. So a little bit of rigour, deep in the forest, something sir, perhaps, Graham. Would that be enough evidence for you that the Constitution is starting to work over there, notwithstanding what happened to the Voting Rights Act the other day as well, down south?
That's the way the Republicans and the Democrats can just pull the rug out from under Trump by not giving him the money, not passing the money to run the war. Which is what America did in Suez. They stopped the war overnight.
And there must have something to do with the alleged ceasefires that are going on. It's just run out of ammo. Well, very
apparently,
nearly. Yeah,
if he can't actually get the weapons, billion. He can't get the budget for the weapons, then he can't have a war.
So certainly, sorry, Leonie, you were saying that?
I was just saying they've apparently spent $25 billion on weaponry so far.
Chicken feed, as somebody said.
That's a lot of money.
Well, I suppose that will be the price of chicken feed quite soon, won't it?
But it's the Republicans that are losing the money that are going to vote against him.
Well, as the Chinese curse says, we live in interesting times. Can I, first of all, I think we can say this on a podcast, Leonie and Mal, wish you all the very best for the 7th. I think it's probably a done deal, but, you know.
I think it's also probably unlikely that I am going to be able to record a podcast next Friday morning, because if any of the results, and Malcolm may feel the same, actually, if any of the results are close and there are recounts, we may not finish until 5 a.m., the likelihood is, because the counting in Wandsworth is an overnight count, ballot boxes close in the polling stations at 10. The ballot papers don't get back to the town hall until 11. They start the count probably by 11:15. They're pretty efficient in Wandsworth. But results will not emerge for quite some time, unless there's a very small turnout or something like that, in which case, and it's all very clear cut everywhere. But it will take at least a couple of hours, if not longer, because they don't count. It's impossible. They've only got a certain number of staff who do the counting, so they don't necessarily count every single ward, all, 22 wards at the same time. So anyway, it goes on until very late. So I think I am going to say that I will not be available Friday morning next week.
I think on the grounds of sheer humanity and implication, that's fully understood.
On the back of that, a mention for the counting staff who do a really good job in winter.
Because
in the past, most people who voted would vote three ways for one of the two major parties. So a huge number of the votes that you're counting just went into one pile or the other, all Labour or all Tory. Now,
split ticket voting.
The number of split ticket voting was relatively minor. Now it's perfectly possible that you're going to get people voting two Labour, one Green, or one Tory, two Reform, or whatever. This will make the whole thing vastly more complicated, because if you just pile up all the Labour votes, all the Tory votes in one column, that's the end of those ballot papers. They're dealt with. If you've got one where you've got to, in one count, you've got to put it in the pile for the first named Labour candidate, say. But quite a few of them are not voting for the other two Labour candidates, then that ballot paper has to, once you've counted the first named Labour candidates' votes, that paper then has to be reallocated to another pile, which might be the top named Green candidate, or it might be whatever is going on. And then it has to be moved to a third pile if there's a third vote that can be something else. And that's a phenomenally more complex issue. So I suspect that it's going to be a much longer night than we've ever seen.
I think it's going to be a long night. And, of course, Malcolm's not mentioning the fact that some people just go in and they kind of go, oh, I don't know what to do, I'll just vote for the first three. And there might be quite a lot of that, because a lot of the ballot papers have got 15 or even 16 names, because there's a few Tusk people standing in various wards, not all wards. You've also got the phenomenon that people go down the ballot paper, which I've noticed before, and they say, oh, I want to just vote for women. And where are the women candidates? And then they vote for the Labour woman, the Green woman, and the Tory woman. Now, I don't understand what politics would drive you, other than being a complete feminist or something, but people do that as well. I mean, people do all sorts of interesting split-ticket voting.
Well, we speculated on the idea of mice and cats voting earlier on. My old friend of the show, Mike Colson, is standing for the Animal Welfare Party this time around. And I'm wondering where your hounds are in that position. Obviously, their welfare is excellent, but some of their mothers and sisters may have a tougher time of it elsewhere, I suppose.
My hounds say that they do prefer to wear a red rosette on their lovely red harnesses. And they're very glad that I've got red harnesses, red collars, and Leeds with a red handle, and they're very happy wearing their lovely Labour little Labour outfits.
Duly dapper.
Very dapper. They are very okay. dapper.
Actually, have one a of great weekend, even, guys, and all is, the best for next Thursday.
One is red in colour, so he's very on brand.
Splendid. We'll see you on the other side. Graham, can we make a date next Friday?
Yeah, we're all waiting for Americans to start quoting the King of England.
We indeed, indeed. Well, I think you heard it here first, and thus it may happen. See you next time.
We'll send you an email, Andy, and let you know that Malcolm and I have won or that we've lost.
Well, I think there'll be something wrong with the fabric of the universe if the latter were the case. Anyway, see you on the other side. Thanks very much.
Bye. Bye. Bye.